Man, you need some Liberty stickers for the back of your truck. At LibertyStickers.com, they've got great state hate, like Pearl Harbor was an inside job. The Democrats want your guns. U.S. Army, die for Israel. Police brutality, not just for black people anymore. And government school, why you and your kids are so stupid. Check out these and 1,000 other great ones at LibertyStickers.com. And of course, they'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at TheBumperSticker.com. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton, and our next guest is Yosef Butt. And he's got a piece here at Foreign Policy called Building Blocks: The Obsession That Is Preventing a Nuclear Deal with Iran. And then also Pretty in Pink: The Parchin Preoccupation Paradox, here at Arms Control Law. Welcome back to the show, Yosef. How are you doing?
Great. Good to be back on.
Well, very happy to have you here. And I'm probably saying your name wrong. I'm sorry. It's Yosef, right?
No, that's fine. Yosef. That's good. Close enough.
Okay. All right. So, hey, great story here. The article, basically your point is that Parchin, this Iranian military base, is a giant red herring that is helping to prevent, or at least casting doubt on, the possible success of the upcoming negotiations with the Iranians on their nuclear program. And so I think I summed that up more or less right. I was hoping we could start off with you explaining about where is Parchin, what's the big deal about it, and then we can get into the politics from there.
Yeah, well, this is a military base about 20 miles, I believe, southeast of Tehran, not too far from Tehran. And it's not a declared nuclear site. So, I mean, it's just a regular military base. And it's a large military base, and the IAEA has visited it twice already. In 2005, and found nothing. The entire site was available to them, so they could have gone to the part that they're interested in now, but they chose to go to some other parts before, and now they're saying, oh, wait, now we want to go here. So the deal is, you know, normally military sites are not something that, that normally a nation is, supposed to allow IAEA inspectors into. They're only supposed to go to their declared nuclear sites and take care of nuclear material, basically inventory that, this is the nuclear material they had, 3 months ago, and this is the amount that they have now. None is missing, good enough. That's their job. Their job isn't, a wild goose chase around military bases that they've visited before.
Mm. All right, so now, the thing of it is, though, is that actually it is kind of their job now, not because of the Non-Proliferation Treaty or the Safeguards Agreement, but because of all the UN Security Council mandates that John Bolton succeeded in pushing through back in the Bush Jr. years, right? They say they have to answer 100,000 questions, and when they're done, they can answer another 100,000 until they've proven a negative beyond a shadow of a doubt.
Right. Well, this is part of the problem. Let me just back up a little bit and just put some context into it. So, part of the problem is there's two sets of negotiations going on. One is between Iran and the IAEA with all these questions. Then the other is the more important one, in my view, which is between Iran and the what's called the P5 plus one. This is the permanent five members of the Security Council plus Germany. Mm-hmm. And that negotiation is the one that, gets into, curtailing Iran's enrichment to 20%. That's the real meat of the issue. That's where we can really cap Iran's program. And that's the one dialogue that needs to go on and needs to be preserved and is important. Now, there's the UN Security Council can encourage Iran, via the sanctions it's put on, to cooperate with the IAEA to fulfill its legal obligations, which are actually the Safeguards Agreement. What it cannot do, and you can ask lawyers, international lawyers such as Dan Joyner, who's written two books on the NPT, specifically on interpreting the NPT. Yes, the UN Security Council can apply pressure onto Iran to get them to cooperate with the IAEA, but it cannot say, well, you have to do all this other stuff that actually wasn't part of the agreement, the safeguards agreement that you signed with the IAEA, but now we want you to do that also. That part is extrajudicial, basically. And that's where I believe that's where a lot of, you know, the hang-ups in these negotiations are occurring, because the Iranians are saying, listen, we had an agreement with you. We showed you our declared nuclear facilities. You're making, you know, every year the IAEA has confirmed that none of the material, the nuclear material, has been diverted to any weapons uses. And, you know, that's basically its job. Mm.
Do I understand it right that the different UN Security Council resolutions that go beyond the safeguards agreement are that they must freeze all uranium enrichment, they must answer all the questions that the IAEA can come up with based on the alleged studies documents and whatever else the Israelis give them, and they must allow access to these non-nuclear facilities, like the factory where they make the centrifuges, or the Parchin military base, where no one has any evidence whatsoever that there's anything nuclear there at all. And this is what it, you know, to watch it on TV, it seems like the poor IAEA can't get a thing done, even though, like you just said, when it comes to actually implementing the safeguards agreement, they have no problem verifying that all the uranium is still accounted for and that none of it is being diverted to weapons purposes. But there's all this other stuff, which is really, if I explained it right, under the UN Security Council mandate. Is that right?
Yeah,
you correct me?
Yeah, that's basically correct. But if you ask international lawyers who are skilled in this field, they'll tell you that the UN Security Council is not supposed to be doing what it's doing, because it basically sets up a never-ending cycle where, you know, When you go outside the law and you just say, well, you have to satisfy these bunch of people's concerns. Now, the concerns, you know, are very subjective. Like, one person can be concerned about certain things and another person may not be concerned about that. What you have to get down to is what is Iran legally obliged to do, and are they doing it? And yes, they are, in fact. And if you listen to our Director of National Intelligence, who gets input from 16 different spy agencies of the U.S., and his consensus view, this is 16 different agencies are agreeing on something, which is, you know, I don't think that happens in D.C. at all, let alone between spy agencies. So the Director of National Intelligence has said he has a high level of confidence that at the moment Iran is not making any nuclear weapons. And, you know, they may in the future. I mean, any country might, you know, they can suddenly change track and do it, and that's a concern, and that's a flaw of the NPT. You know, it doesn't foreclose the option in the future. Anything can happen in the future. But the Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, has said that he has a high level of confidence that nothing, you know, no nuclear weapons work is going on right now. The Al-Baradei, who is 12-year head of the IAEA, says basically the same thing. He doesn't have a shred of evidence that he hasn't seen a shred of evidence that Iran is weaponizing.
And what a great quote, by the way, because I was familiar with him always saying he has no evidence and, in fact, no indication of any diversion. But I hadn't seen the one where he said, not a shred of evidence. What a quotable quote of Mohammed Al-Baradei there.
Yeah, that's actually in Seymour Hersh's piece from last year on the Iran nuclear program.
Oh, Iran and the bomb, yeah.
Touch base on that offline.
Gotcha. Yeah, I'd forgotten that quote then, because that's a good piece. I read it. All right, now, so to get the focus back on Parchin, the military base here, this whole thing has already been proven to be a big joke, right? The chamber that they say must be a nuclear implosion systems testing chamber is no such thing. The Soviet-era nuclear weapons scientist is no such thing. And They're saying that the reason that they're so suspicious is because they're washing the ground with hoses, and that's supposed to wash away the dust of radioactive particles so that the IAEA could never find it. That's what they're saying? I mean, what kind of nonsense is this? Does anyone in the world believe this? It's almost like after they debunked the aluminum tubes in the Washington Post in September 2002, and then the Republicans kept invoking the aluminum tubes for another year and a half after that. Remember?
A lot of this is being fed by the ISIS group, which is the Institute for Science and International Studies, and they were part of the several outfits that were scaremongering over Iraq before, and they seem to be doing a similar thing now. What's interesting is they never come out and clearly say that Iran is doing something wrong. They'll just say, well, there are indications of possible, perhaps, these vague speculations. So they'll put all these speculations out with sexy overhead satellite pictures that are poorly interpreted and create this fear-mongering in the media. If you want the real scoop on this, there's a person called Robert Kelly, who has actually worked in the U.S. Department of Energy weapons complex at Los Alamos and Livermore for 35 years, and he headed the IAEA inspections in Iraq twice. And he has a report out at the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute just from a couple of days ago, which overturns a lot of the nonsense that the ISIS group has been propagating in the media. So that's definitely worth a read. Now, about the tank, it could be it's not the best way to do these tests, but sure, we don't know. There could be a tank there. They could have done something. But, even if the worst case, it's conventional explosives that that were tested in a setting that may have been relevant for nuclear weapons research. It wasn't a bomb factory, even if we believe all the worst-case scenarios.
And a decade ago,
And it's from way long ago. So from 10 years ago. So buying into this and making a huge mountain out of a molehill it just poisons the well negotiations in general. But and makes it look like Iran is not cooperating and hurts the chances of the important negotiations that need to take place on stopping Iran's 20% enrichment, because that really is, I'm not saying that they're using that, that they have an intention to use that 20% uranium for bomb fuel, but it can be, in the future, if there's the sanctions keep up, people get pissed off, there's a new regime that's more hardline, who knows what they might do. And if they have the 20% enriched stockpile, it's potential bomb fuel. So we need to urgently stop Iran from doing that, and we need to put everything on the table to get them to do that, including sanctions relief. What puzzles me is, on the one hand, we say we're very worried about Iran doing this, and on the other hand, we offer them aircraft parts as compensation for them stopping this. If you're really seriously afraid about something, you put something on the table, you get them to stop it, whatever the cost. And we're not doing that. We're not Syria. We're negotiating in bad faith.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, I was talking with Mohammed Sahimi about this yesterday. And I think it was the latest IAEA report. It could have been the one before that, where they talked about how the Iranians are now taking their 20% U-235, enriched U-235, and they're manufacturing fuel plates out of it, and they're actually using it as fuel, or they're, fixing to use it as fuel in their medical isotope reactor, just like they said all along. And it seems like, and the way I interpreted that was, it was a little bit of a signal that, like, hey, that breakout capability that you guys are so afraid of, here we are getting rid of it. This whole the breakout we've built up so far, we're going to go ahead and make fuel plates out of these out of this 20%, rather than sit around waiting to possibly continue to enrich it up to 90%. That seemed to me like it was kind of a preemptive good faith measure on their part. No?
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. They're not converting all of it, but as much as they need. I believe they have some problems, technical problems in in doing that conversion. But yeah, basically you take the gaseous uranium hexafluoride and you make metallic plates out of it, and in that process it becomes much more difficult than try to reconvert it back into gas and then re-enrich it. So yeah, that definitely is an indication that they're doing what they said they would. Now, if you look at the red lines, ever since the 1980s, there's been reports that Iran is on the verge of nuclear weapons. West German intelligence said in 1984 they're in the final stages of weaponizing. Netanyahu in 1992 said Iran is 3 to 5 years from a nuclear bomb. So, this kind of scaremongering has been going on all along. But the important thing is our best intelligence, our 16 spy agencies have a consensus view that there is no nuclear weapons program in Iran right now.
Right. And they've been saying that nonstop since 2007, including under oath before the Senate and all that, as you already mentioned, Director of National Intelligence.
The problem is there's an outfit called ISIS in Washington, D.C., which has an agenda to I'm not sure what the agenda is, but it certainly isn't to resolve this issue quickly. And they seem to be ignoring everything that the actual professional intelligence agencies are saying. And they put on these satellite pictures and have wrong interpretations of them, which Robert Kelly has corrected in his recent SIPRI report. That report is the one that the media should take into consideration now.
Right. Well, and it's interesting, too. Mohammed and I talked about this yesterday also, that this actual set of accusations about Parchin have been debunked by David Albright's number one source in the whole world that everybody knows is his source, Ali Heinonen, the very hawkish, the bad cop to Mohammed El-Baradei's good cop at the IAEA back over the past years. And he even debunked it in the New York Times in a David Sanger piece, who is, as bad as David Albright on most everything and quotes him all the time. And so, it's basically Albright's mentor is the one who debunked this, it looks like, or his handler, however you put it.
Well, I think in this case, Ali is correct. The problem is now, inspect the site. You don't tell the people, I'm interested in this building, and please let me in, a year from now. Because then, even if you go there and you find nothing, you can say, you had a year and you probably cleaned it. So what there's no logical way out of it. They're not going to have something honking bright in there that shows their guilt. And they're not, if you found nothing instead, you're still not off the hook because you said you had nothing. So the way you do it is, as they did in 2005, the Iranians said, here's all of Parchin. Okay, we're going to divide it into 4 bits. Choose any one you want. You can choose it on the day that you drive up to it. And within that sector, because it's a huge base, you can choose up to 5 random buildings. So it was completely randomized. The Iranians didn't know where the IAEA is going to go until Ali drove up that day and chose the sector and the buildings and went and inspected it. So they had opened up the entire site. If there were really something seriously suspicious there, they probably would not have done that. So you have to look into the methodology that the IAEA is using now. They're already semaphored which building that they're interested in, and now even if they find nothing there, they can say, you knew all along we were interested in this one, and you probably cleaned it. So, there's just doubt. It's a logical bind.
Right. It's interesting, too, that if I remember the story right, this is David Albright's only real claim to fame is that he went to a quote-unquote cleaned site in South Africa and found traces of nuclear activity where it had been denied in the past. And because you can't wash away radioactive dust with a garden hose. And they had tried.
Right. I mean, this stuff is very persistent. You'd want to do it is go in the buildings and look in where, basically like where the dust accumulates in your house, in the corners at the bottom of the you know, where the walls meet the floor, and, you know, and in those areas. And you just take a swipe, and because it's so sensitive, the method of detecting is so sensitive, you can pick up tiny traces years later. So, all this stuff about the water outside and landscaping is ridiculous. I mean, you don't take soil samples outside to do this kind of stuff. And even if they use the water, that water would have accumulated. If they were using the water to hide the uranium, the water would, you know, basically concentrate all the uranium in where it eventually up. So, you know, that's not a smart way if you're trying to actually hide this thing. So, you know, the David Albright is not a scientist. He doesn't have a PhD. He's never worked in science. I don't know what his claim to fame is, but it isn't certainly based on any technical skills.
Yeah, he likes to pretend he's a physicist, or he doesn't correct the Post when they call him one, and he likes to call himself a former IAEA inspector when, in fact, he was allowed to tag along once or something.
Yeah, he was basically a tourist on one of the trips that the actual person who knows what he's talking about, Robert Kelly, headed.
Right. All right. And now, so let me ask you this about, as you said, there are two different tracks here. They're negotiating with the IAEA over Parchin, but this is the big red herring that seems like it very well could screw up the P5+1 negotiations, which, when are they supposed to kick back in again? Or have they set a date for the next set of talks?
Yeah, they were supposed to happen in, you know, a week or a couple of weeks. And actually, indications are from this morning that Iran has proposed Egypt, Cairo, as the site, and now the ball's in the P5+1 court. If they like the weather in Cairo these days.
And now, has the administration ever really said that they would accept enrichment at 3.6%? I mean, there's a lot of focus on the 20% enriched uranium, and it seemed like when they proposed the deal originally in 2009, they sort of were implying that they would accept 3.6%. But they never have really said that, have they, that they would accept any enrichment at all inside Iran?
Well, I don't, you know, a huge... The problem is no one knows what the negotiating position of the P5+1 is, insofar as what will it take to remove sanctions. No one knows. Iran has been pretty clear. They even went into the deal brokered by Turkey and Brazil, and you know it was all crystalline what they were going to do. And the deal had been set up, but then it fell through because, after Iran had agreed to it, P5+1 basically couldn't take yes for an answer, and they found some flaw with it. They would be lucky to get that deal because Iran is in a stronger position, has accumulated more. Everything is getting harder as we delay. So, we don't know what the administration will be satisfied with. If you read the legislative text of the sanctions, there's a lot of things in there way beyond anything having to do with the nuclear program. So basically, if you read what Congress requires to lift sanctions on Iran, Iran would have to let go of all its political prisoners. It would have to stop terrorism. It would have to do all, which are good, these are laudable goals, It's not a great, it's not a good regime, but, putting these conditions into nuclear negotiations complicates things because you're basically messaging to the Iranians that, hey, no matter what you do with your nuclear program, we're still going to have the sanctions on because you haven't released the political prisoners. So, then the Iranians are, of course, going to say, well, what are we doing here? Why are we talking? What are we talking about?
Right. So, well, this is the same thing that happened in the 90s with Saddam Hussein. They said, starting in 1997, that no matter what he does, no matter what he verifies, no matter what access to what inspectors, to his palaces or anything else, we will never lift the sanctions as long as Saddam Hussein is in power. So he said, then get the hell out with your inspectors, because why am I even going along with you at all? Well, and that's oversimplifying,
exactly.
But he basically quit cooperating at that point.
Exactly, and it's legislative text. It's not something I'm looking up. You can go and you can you can go to my most recent foreign policy article, and I have the link to the Congress where the Congress has published the details of the sanctions and all their conditions for lifting it, which are frankly ridiculous.
Right, as you said. Now, in fact, could you go through that list real quick for us? So I'm paging through the article here looking for it.
Let me see if I don't know.
You mentioned one of them they have to release all their political prisoners. Well,
yeah.
I'm sure they'll go along right with that over there.
No, and you know, and the other part is some of them are impossible to verify. You know, one of them is Iran has, I'm paraphrasing, has given up its support of terrorism. Like, how is the president going to certify to Congress that Iran has given up, even if it does so, has given up its support of terrorism? You know, it's just one of those things that are, you know, impossible to certify.
Right.
Now, I should say that the president can waive those requirements on the basis of national security and say, hey, on the basis of national security, we're not going to make Iran do all these things. But the problem is, then he will come off as seeming soft on Iran, and he'll run a great political risk. And, you know, you'll have all of Congress pointing at him saying he's been soft on Iran. So, you know, that's part of the issue. It's unlikely that he's ever going to use that waiver.
Mm-hmm. And now, it's funny, I was just talking with Max Blumenthal about Obama's position on the West Bank. He never heard of it, and he's going to try to do his best to ignore it for the rest of his term. Do you think he's just going to try to stick with the status quo here, or do you think he possibly would want to actually make a deal and say, we'll lift some sanctions if you promise to stick with the additional protocol forever, or that kind of thing?
It's hard to say. I mean, you know, he has a little bit more flexibility now because, you know, that's his last term. He won't be able to run again, and he could take some greater political risks. And the new cabinet, if Hagel and Kerry are actually approved, does, you know, is a hopeful sign. So I think there is some cause for hope, but it's impossible for me to judge, you know, the detailed politics of that.
Okay, well, everybody, that is Yosef Butt. He's a nuclear physicist, a professor and scientist in residence at the James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies at the Monterey Institute of International Studies. And this piece is called Building Blocks at foreignpolicy.com and also at armscontrollaw.com. Check out Pretty in Pink, The Parchin Preoccupation Paradox. Thank you very much for your time, Yosef.
Thank you, Scott.
Hey, everybody, Scott Horton here. You ought to consider advertising on the show. Here's how it'll work. You give me money, and then I'll tell everybody how great your stuff is. They'll buy it, and we'll all be rich as Republicans. Sound pretty good? Shoot me an email, scott@scotthorton.org, and we'll work it out.
The Emergency Committee for Israel. Brookings, Heritage, AIPAC, WINEP, GINSA, PNAC, CNAS, the AEI, FPI, CFR, and CSP. It sure does seem sometimes like the war party's got the foreign policy debate in D.C. all locked up. But not quite. Check out the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. They put America first, opposing our government's world empire, and especially their Middle Eastern madness. That's the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here, inviting you to check out WallStreetWindow.com. It's a financial blog written by former hedge fund manager Mike Swanson, who's investing in commodities, mining stocks, and European markets. Wall Street Window is unique in that Mike shows people what he's really investing in and updates you when he buys or sells in his main account. Mike thinks his positions are going to go up because of all the money the Federal Reserve is printing to finance the deficit. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. And Mike's got a great new book coming out, so also keep your eye on writermichaelswanson.com for more details. Hey everybody, Scott Horton here, inviting you to check out the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org. They've got a brand new website with new and improved access to more than 20 years worth of essays promoting the cause of liberty. And FFF's writers, including Jacob Hornberger, Jim Bovard, Sheldon Richmond, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and more, aren't just good. They're the best at opposing and discrediting our corrupt overlords in Washington and their warfare, welfare, regulatory police state. That's the Future Freedom Foundation's new and improved site at fff.org. Hey ladies, Scott Horton here. If you would like truly youthful, healthy, and healthy-looking skin, there is one very special company you need to visit, Dagny & Lane, at dagnyandlane.com. Dagny Lane has revolutionized the industry with a full line of products made from organic and all-natural ingredients that penetrate deeply with nutrient-rich ionic minerals and antioxidants for healthy and beautiful skin. That's Dagny and Lane at DagnyandLane.com. And for a limited time, add promo code SCOTT15 at checkout for a 15% discount.